Welcome to Strat Talks, the podcast for strategy. I'm Isabel Schnellbügel, your host of edition number 3. Get ready to dive into the hottest topic right now, artificial intelligence. Joined by experts from top-notch agencies, startups, and companies, we're about to explore the impact of AI on our work as strategists, both now and in the future. Hello and welcome back to Strat Talks. Today I'm here with Alex Beresford, Chief Growth Officer and Chief Marketing Officer at TaxFix. Alex, thanks so much for joining Strat Talks. I'm super pumped that you're here. Before we dive into the topic of our episode, which is AI, can you please introduce yourself a little bit to our listeners? What's your role? What are you currently doing? Just give us a little intro.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on Strat Talks. It really is an honor. My name's Alex. I've lived around the world as an oil and gas kid, but I call Europe home. I'm Dutch by origin. I've been working in software tech businesses for most of my career, usually in commercial roles or product-related roles. Currently at TaxFix, covering a combination of growth, country management, brand, marketing, some product responsibilities. But they're all geared towards making taxes as simple and as enjoyable as we can make them across the world. It's pretty exciting and definitely touched a lot on the topic of AI over the course of the last 10 years.
That's amazing. And it sounds like you're a super busy person. So thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today. You just said you spent your whole career of more than 10 years in the software and tech industry. Let's maybe start by looking back a little bit. AI, as we all know, and why we're talking as well, is a hype topic right now, mostly because Gen AI is kind of showing some pretty insane results that people feel like they're kind of magical. However, AI and machine learning have been around for a while. And now maybe looking back at your career, can you give us some insight into how AI has affected your work in the last 10 years? What was already true 10 years ago for AI?
Yeah, I think my personal journey was something along the lines of coming out of university. I went to business school and was finished in 2012. I tried psychology and law and finished business school. I could get through that. AI and machine learning, this was not top of mind back in business schools. Like back then, software tech was just one of many industries. So coming out of it, I didn't really know at all what it was. And it wasn't until I started working at PayPal at the time that I realized I have a strong affinity with data and processing data in ways that either helps the business or helps customers. And this is when I started to get exposed to these concepts of artificial intelligence, but more often machine learning, which is considered a discipline of AI often. Back then, though, we're talking 2013, 2014, most people thought AI was kind of only present in their life because of the recommendations on like an e-commerce website. It's like, oh, it's recommending a book to me. Like, how fascinating is that? And that was where often people thought that it was only present in their lives. At PayPal, though, back then already, AI and machine learning were at the very core of how the business created value for customers. If you think about it, on PayPal, you'd put in an email address and you'd instantly get an answer if the payment was done or not. And this wasn't really feasible for any other company in the world. But it wasn't just that. It was no matter where you were in the world, if you were in Cape Town in South Africa and you were buying something in the US, you'd also instantly get an answer if the payment was accepted or not. Under the hood, these AI and ML capabilities were really at the heart of how risk and how fraud and how payments were managed that made it possible for consumers anywhere in the world to have an instant payment. And this was really fascinating at the time because I saw it through PayPal and then I got to learn about Visa, MasterCard, and all these payments companies, just the scale at which these payments companies were processing data with machine learning techniques to help consumers just have no friction in their experience. And you're talking about millions, billions of data points across dozens of data centers spread across the whole world, across a whole range of companies. Without AI and ML, that wouldn't really have been feasible because you'd have lost way too much to fraudsters or to high-risk transactions to make the business model work. I thought I understood what that meant until I started learning Python. I was quite adept at Excel. I had affinity with data, and I picked up Python for data scientists in I think it was 2014 or something like this. And just with sort of 10 or 11 rows of code, which is a very small amount of code, it was mind-blowing to see how you could take hundreds of thousands of data points and run it through a Python library and get a relatively simplistic machine learning driven outcome just because you had electricity. So like, okay, I got all this data, I've got Python and I've got electricity, and you put those things together, these are infinite. Like there's almost infinite data, there's almost infinite electricity. So that's when it clicked in my mind, like, oh, okay, this AI and ML space is basically, if you have electricity and you have data, you can do some really crazy things in terms of helping create value for customers, helping create value for the business, solving personal problems, personal budgeting in milliseconds, where Excel is already, it's a pretty advanced tool. I think people underestimate how advanced Excel is as a consumer product. But going into sort of software coding taught me even more about what was actually feasible, which was kind of mind-blowing. Coming out of that, I went into a couple of startups, and in one of them, I had opportunity to get very close to the risk and data science functions to see how does a data scientist or a risk manager help a small business get a loan when the banks are rejecting them, but they really need a loan to survive or to thrive. And if you look back, though, at the models that were being used, either by all of these big payments companies or by these alternative lending companies that were helping small businesses, the maths that they were using, so the mathematics under it all, this is kind of decades old in most cases, sort of developed in the 80s, the 90s, sometimes even earlier than that. But it wasn't until 2010, 11, 12, 13, 14 that consumers were starting to experience this everywhere due to cloud infrastructure. So cloud infrastructure growing, being able to access computers remotely, digitally, instantly, made it so that consumers could have AI and ML-driven experiences when they often had absolutely no idea what was under the hood. The math, though, is decades old. So what was already true 10 years ago or decades ago is that mathematics had created what we needed to make consumers' lives, let's say, more convenient and more enjoyable. Cloud infrastructure caught up, and all of a sudden you put those things together and you have some AI and ML-driven experiences at scale. I call that the sort of the second and the third wave of AI and ML. And currently we're in the fourth wave in my mind, but we'll get more into that in a sec.
Exactly. And I mean, it's fascinating to hear you talk about how, you know, those different ingredients kind of shape where we are today and how all of that already happened under the hood. I mean, what we're seeing today, and as you said, we're going to talk a little bit more about that, but it's kind of the first time that it, like, people are really aware of it, and it becomes something that people, like every person basically talks about and kind of at least tries to understand. I remember a couple of years ago, we got a brief from a technology company to explain the AI that's in the camera of a phone. And it was such a difficult task because people got really afraid of it when we did consumer interviews. No one really understood what it meant. They felt like, is it like spy software? And it was such a difficult task at that time. But now everyone's talking about it, right? So the discourse has changed quite a bit. So let's move on today. You know, I just said AI is now front and center of many conversations, at least in our bubbles. What's your perspective on the new truth of AI? What are we seeing today that is different from the time and the things that you just described?
Yeah, I've been trying to connect the dots now for about, give or take, a year. Very often relying on people much smarter than me. So what can I see? You mentioned ingredients. So if the first ingredient was sort of cloud infrastructure, and the second ingredient was the mathematics, and the third ingredient is big enough data sets. So if you think about what's been going on now for decades is, well, people have been present on the internet, people have been present on social media, they've been using their phones, they've been using other devices, and they've been creating huge data sets about social discourse, conversation, content, perspectives. Like the human race has really presented itself digitally in the last couple of decades. So the third ingredient is huge data sets. And the fourth ingredient is consumer adoption rates of software tech. If you look where we are today, the majority of people that have access to a, let's say, processing capable device like a phone or a computer, they are also capable of using the internet, and they're capable of adopting a service at an incredible rate. And I think we saw a couple of weeks ago, the adoption rate of ChatGPT, it was the fastest adopted digital consumer product in the history of mankind. Something like 100 million users in a couple of weeks, if I remember correctly, or even days.
I think days, yeah.
Yeah, so that those two ingredients being combined with the other four ingredients puts us into a new situation, a new what is going on here situation. So I started labeling that as the fourth wave of AI. And this one feels different, though. This one feels more like there's a new wave every 3 months. So it means that we're only just at the start of this fourth wave as well. This is not sort of, oh, one thing changes and 5 years later, another thing changes. It's like, no, we can see every 3 months that really big leaps are being made across a whole range of generative AI models mostly. There are also other areas of AI developing quite quickly, but as day-to-day consumers, we just don't really see that much. But the one that's really in our face is this sort of every 3 months, every 2 months, sometimes even every month, a generative AI leap is made. So I come to a couple of conclusions as a result. The first one is, these are going to be a bit provocative as well, but that's also, I've been labeled a change agent more often than not in my career. I'll continue doing that.
I love that.
The first one is that anybody that's in a job where we're expected to gather information and then make decisions, all of our jobs have changed overnight and we're all playing catch up. I'll give you practically an idea of what kind of jobs those are. An intern is expected to gather information on some specific set of customers and to enter it into a system and then to make decisions if they press a button or not, to submit the data, for example. Versus a C-level, like a CMO, is expected on a daily basis to evaluate where is the market going and do we have the right strategy and are our resources aligned with our strategy and what are our capabilities that we need? These are examples of gathering information and then making decisions on them. For those roles and everything in between, so from intern up to sort of the C-level of an organization, I personally believe that job expectations have changed overnight for 9 months now, and we're all playing catch-up. That's what it feels like to me. Second thing that I've concluded is creativity across commerce and art has gone from roughly 10% feasible with machines. Like, we were all making fun of what some models were doing like 5 years ago, 10 years ago. I'd call that 10% feasible to roughly 70% of what a human being can do in terms of creative thinking and expression. And I say the 70% as sort of the start of the fourth wave. 70% is not the end. Like, we've just started and it's already at roughly 70% of what a human being can do. And we'll get into more detail on that later as well, on where I think that comes from. Thirdly, what I've concluded is that this is going to be more like the steam engine than the mobile phone. So when the steam engine came around, I think some of us know the history about manufacturing, and it basically replaced manual labor in large amounts and productivity went through the roof. With mobile phones, it was more a nice to have, made life a bit more convenient and accessible. Communications access went up, but it was ultimately not that much of a game changer for everybody, for productivity. And because it's more like the steam engine than the mobile phone, the market, like, we do live in a capitalist society, the market will expect explicitly productivity gains from everyone because it's now feasible. This is not going to be negotiable. Capitalism is not going to slow down in that sense. And lastly, the fourth thing I've concluded, generative AI is not going to substitute critical thinking for quite a while. By that, I mean maybe months, a year or two. However, it's also not impossible to imagine that generative AI can take over the patterns of critical thinking when we start seeing constellations of models do most of the, let's say, effort in what humans call critical thinking that most humans are capable of too. So critical thinking is currently our advantage and it's going to erode quite quickly in the next 1 or 2 years across most functions. So kind of four conclusions on what is different today versus what I saw in the past.
Yeah, I think those are provocative thoughts, really, because they paint a picture where we have to adapt quite swiftly to the new realities, or as you said, maybe catch up. You already teased it. Let's kind of dive a little bit deeper into the topic of generative AI. What's currently going on there?
Yeah, I have to try and contain my excitement a bit. I'm very positive about these changes. I think it's a good thing. I think it's going to get us forward as a race collectively, you know, make life better for a lot of people, make life better for more people than that it makes it worse. I think it's a combination of two factors. What I started doing when I started seeing ChatGPT and Midjourney and DALL-E and these models is I was asking myself, what's going on here? And I went to, I went to podcasts and to YouTube and Google search and just looking like, okay, what are the smartest people in the world think about this? The people that work at the frontier of using these technologies. And the answers that I got was not really sufficient. What I heard was a bunch of hidden agendas. Either people thought it was good or people thought it was bad. But what I was missing was, what's actually going on? Like, under the hood, what is this specifically? So I decided I have to dig myself. So I started using ChatGPT, started using DALL-E and Midjourney, and started reading not from the people that talk about these models, but reading from the people that build the pieces of these models or contribute to them. And there was one article that taught me the most. It's an article from a guy called Stephen Wolfram. If you're in software technology, it'll be a familiar name. It's quite a well-known person in computer science. I think the article is called "What is ChatGPT and How Does It Work?" But essentially in that article, if you have some technical understanding, you can read along, and there's one sentence that really caught my attention. It was something along the lines of, before what was considered a computer challenge that a computer could not solve has now become a challenge that a computer can solve. And that's described as one of the two factors that really matters. So the first factor that really matters is a lot of things that human beings thought a computer couldn't do, that has now changed. That's called computational reducibility. And it means a computer can do now what we thought it couldn't do before. And the second thing that has changed is that it's become very easy for subject matter experts. So what do I mean by a subject matter expert? Let's take a brand manager, or let's take a sales manager. They have now gotten access to AI and ML tools where before you would require a software engineer or a machine learning engineer or some kind of heavy interface to interact with these systems. That's no longer the case. As consumer UIs, it's quite easy to access. So you have subject matter experts coming together with computational reducibility. Those are the two factors that are driving what is going on here. Now, the implication is that large amounts of all of our jobs have become feasible by a computer. It means that a lot of the information gathering and or the decision making can now be reduced to a task that a computer can do it, not just a human. Let's give you a very practical example. Coming up with 10 creative concepts that might not be the most mind-blowing concepts in the world, but are still very high quality, this can now be done by a computer for marketing campaigns in milliseconds. And people that think that it's not feasible, I'd love to talk to you and help you understand how this is feasible, because this is the reality today. That's just one of many examples that are today now feasible. And I can pinpoint examples across pretty much any profession. You give me the profession, I'll give you an example of which part of their job is now computationally reducible. Now, why is that? It's because very often when we make decisions in our jobs day to day, so for example, the C-level executive that decides that a strategy is the right strategy, most of these decisions come from us simply connecting patterns consciously and subconsciously in our mind and stitching them together. So when you connect patterns, they're quite predictable, because patterns for a generative AI model is just a matter of, do you have enough data and did the model find the pattern or not? And if you feed a model like this with all of the data that's available out there, then it will identify the patterns that make it possible to have a discussion with a C-level executive about the viability of their strategy. This is not simple work. It's incredibly complicated work to reason on this stuff. And it's now feasible. It's now reducible into a size that a computer can participate or even often do it better than people can. And the second thing that's going on, so we've got those two factors. We've got the computational reducibility. We've got the accessibility for subject matter experts. The second is, in the world of creative output in either art or commerce, I'm a CMO. I spend quite a bit of time on how do we tell stories and how do we paint a picture of what matters to our customers and to other stakeholders, and how do you bring to life the vision of the brand and do it in a way that it's relatable and distinct and memorable and unique. Like, let's call that creative work. At the core of it, human beings experience creative work as a strike of lightning. So, or like an epiphany. I imagine you've experienced it yourself as well several times. It's like, all of a sudden, like, oh yeah, there's this great idea I have on some kind of marketing work or sales work or some way to tell a story, where in reality, we're often just coming up with a set of patterns or a combination that others have thought of before. We're just not aware of it, like, because our minds are not all connected. We're not aware of what everybody else has thought, but we connect some patterns, and that intuition, that emotion that comes with creativity, we experience that as creativity, but it's often just a combination of patterns. If you give a generative AI model enough data and enough electricity, it can identify the vast majority of patterns that already exist and simply combine them as well, which means that creativity, that intuitive, emotional, human feeling, at its core, one could argue it's about combining patterns into a creation. Generative AI can do this now too. This has now, my best understanding is 70% or so. So the majority of creative work has become computationally reducible. And most people don't like that, from what I've seen. Other people, though, I've seen adopt it in a way that it's refreshing. It's made their jobs interesting again. It's really become part of their day-to-day lives, and it's made the creative professions quite enjoyable. So it's just two examples of what's going on, and I think people owe it to themselves to learn about computational reducibility. That's what taught me the most.
Thank you. And yeah, I mean, regarding the topic that some people like it and others don't, I think it's the same with every big change that is, and in this case, you talked about kind of the steam engine as kind of an example that shows how big this change is. And so I think it's probably a natural reaction for some to be a bit, you know, hesitant about adopting it. But I fully agree, right? I mean, you have to kind of understand what's going on and how you can embed it in your work. And that's a great segue also to my next question, which is switching gears a little bit. I want to make it a little bit more practical. Can you share some insights into how your company, how TaxFix, has incorporated AI? Are there any major changes to your strategy, the way you develop products, the way you plan marketing, or anything like that?
Yeah, so TaxFix was founded, I think it's now 7 years ago, if I remember correctly. And from the beginning, we had an understanding that consumers want simplicity, convenience, ease of use, speed, and accuracy in their tax filing. And one of the ways that AI was introduced was not, I wouldn't call that at the time the most cutting edge way, but it was, how do you take this entire tax code and make it really simple to understand for people? For that, you have to build a pretty complex system that one might describe as a rudimentary artificial intelligence of how a tax expert might go through a tax case. So the starting step of the company was to build some kind of rudimentary AI with a very small team to figure out how to do this for consumers on a mobile phone as well. And that was hugely successful. Then over time, what we've realized, in especially now with generative AI, that there's a couple of other changes that we want to lean into. Let's start with the productivity side. I'd consider myself embracing generative AI with open arms. There's still a lot of open questions about intellectual property, copyright, and all of these challenges. But ultimately, I want to try and learn and figure out how to work with these systems myself. So the first major change is I personally just try to rewrite my job on a monthly basis or bi-monthly basis currently. And before, I was doing that sort of every 6 months. Something that myself and one of the founders spoke about quite often is just every 6 months, like, rewrite your responsibilities as a manager and a leader and to keep up with the speed of the growth of the company. But now generative AI is changing my job once every month. That's how I'm experiencing it. So the first major change is rewrite my own job once a month and help people in the company understand that, you know, they can benefit from this too. And this perspective of constantly embracing change and this growth mindset and applying it to generative AI, really bringing that into the organization, I think, is helping a lot. Then in terms of how we develop products, I think we have to strike the balance between, this is still taxes. Like, we take customers' data incredibly seriously. We take the law incredibly seriously. These are all super important for us because ultimately we have the obligation to follow the law primarily and to be compliant primarily. And then secondarily, if a user allows us, then how can we create more value for them? So trying to navigate what that means for us in terms of, can you use generative AI or not? This is not it's not an obvious answer. And you can see with European governments that they're all kind of trying to figure out what the answer is to this question, especially around certain professions. where we're participating in the conversation and also trying to understand ourselves, you know, what's in the best interest of the customer, what's compliant with the law. Generative AI is raising a whole bunch of questions on that end. So I'd call that major changes to how we think about helping customers have a better experience, especially when a new technology comes out. And then I'd say on the marketing side, we've gone a step further because we've built sort of a range of tools. We have quite a large marketing technology team that allow us to be very efficient in our advertising efforts and in our marketing automation efforts to do things at a certain scale, like a lot of other companies do. But here with generative AI, we've realized we can even go a step further. I'll just give you a pragmatic example, is that when a copywriter comes up with a concept and it really is sort of their own, to then come up with the iterations of that concept is typically weeks of work in the past to do it at scale for a large campaign. But now this is not weeks, this is milliseconds if you do it in the right way. So we start with the idea and we use generative AI to help us bring it to life. It's really quite fascinating what it can do. This is one of many examples. It's kind of a sparring partner in our creative efforts.
Thank you. I think the idea of rewriting your job every 6 months or now every 2 months is great. And I think specifically, you know, in marketing and marketers, for them, like for all of us, but specifically in this area, so much is changing and has changed in the past couple of years. So kind of taking stock and figuring out what to do next and where to go next and really making that a very conscious process is such a great way of doing it. And thank you also for sharing those examples for TaxFix. You mentioned there are other ways that you apply AI in your marketing efforts. Can you maybe give a couple more examples?
Yeah, I mean, so let's use an example that we did with Accenture Song recently even as well. And this is not, I'm not getting paid to say this, but this is literally what happened. We were shooting a TV commercial for TaxFix. And in one of the scenes, some of the copywriting, when I saw it being recorded, so when you'll get on set and you'll see the recording, and it's only then that you start to see all the ingredients come together, the copywriting, the visuals, the sound, the light, the, let's say, ambiance. And sometimes then only things become clear. And this was the first time I was on set as well. So it was a very rich experience. And what I saw there was one of the lines just didn't feel right. And typically, that would have been a nightmare for a production agency because the client is on set and says, I don't like that line. Can you please change the shooting schedule for the day? And I was a bit oblivious to how much chaos that can cause because it was the first time I'd been on set. Instead, though, it became actually quite an interesting opportunity. So I opened up my laptop, fired up one of Jasper.ai's tools. I took the initial concept, so the script that we had written for the TV campaign with the song creative director, and we forced it through Jasper.ai and asked it to come up with 10 variations, keeping in mind what we had just learned on set. And the first couple that it spit out were, you could say, junior copywriter grade stuff. But then you prompt it again 1 minute later, then you get a sort of mid-level to senior copywriting stuff. And ultimately what came out of it was sort of, I think it was 10 to 15 new perspectives on the spot, like in the tent where you're watching the recording. So you're not interrupting production, or at least I didn't have the feeling that I was interrupting production. And I showed it to the creative director. And what it did at the time was it sparked the decision to go with one of the ideas that we had come up with actually before the shooting, because the examples that generative AI came up with, and we're talking now like a good 9-12 months ago, so it was on the former GPT models. It wasn't the same quality as the models are today. But just confronting ourselves with the fact that, okay, we could think about it like this, made it so much easier to say, okay, let's take the risk and let's go with the one that we thought we shouldn't go with from before the shoot. I don't think I could have triggered people to take the risk if I didn't on the spot come up with competing perspectives. So I wasn't on the spot attacking our own strategy, so to say. And I think generative AI in marketing, the first way we use it is something called create and destroy. There's a fascinating book called Good Strategy, Bad Strategy. I can highly recommend it to people to read. And there's a concept described in the book called create and destroy, where you go and create your strategy. It can be a small strategy, a big strategy. It could be for a huge obstacle or small obstacle. And very often in marketing, our obstacles are quite small, but we do need a strategy. Generative AI is very good at helping us create, but also helping us destroy. And that means to attack our thoughts and to make our thoughts better. That was the first example. Very pragmatic, literally in the TV recording tent. I think I gave some of the team members a bit of a heart attack, and the client is asking for crazy stuff, I'm sure, came through some people's minds. But that's one of the pragmatic examples. We've also started using it in our efforts to better understand customers. You see, what a lot of people, I don't think, realize yet about ChatGPT in the marketing profession is, today, when you wake up on Monday, you are no longer a brand manager, or you're no longer a copywriter, or you're no longer a product manager or a sales manager. When you wake up, you are who you are. So let's say I am a brand manager, but I also have 70% of a sales manager, creative director, CMO, VP design. Like, I have all of these people, they all work for me because ChatGPT makes it possible to talk with it like it is those people and to help you with your job from the perspective of those people. Very practically, you wake up as a brand manager and you're evaluating some visual design and you're asking yourself, is this good enough for the context that we're in? Is this good enough for the customer? Is this good enough for the client? Like before, you know, you'd have to sit down and think, and you could be wrong very easily, or you just would lack perspectives. Now you can just upload the image and say, attack this, or help me improve it because I want to do better. And it's now feasible because ChatGPT has given you a VP of design, it's given you a product marketer, it's given you a copywriter. It's like it can think like that, or at least represent the train of thought in words. So it's not really thinking, it's just effectively predicting words, but it can predict the train of thought in a way that we humans can read it and go, oh, that's how I can do my job better. So yeah, we have to all start waking up on Monday and realize that we can do more than one job now, because generative AI allows us to have so many sparring partners and sounding boards that before we didn't have because people were too busy. Now you have them all instant on your phone. Like, when I walk my dog, I'm more often talking to ChatGPT than I am paying attention to the outside world, because I just want to discuss thoughts that come to my mind, and I have this sparring partner and it can actually talk back to me and help me reason and do my critical thinking. It's in your pocket for all marketing professions.
I can feel the excitement that you have definitely come through. And I mean, talking about the example in the tent, and I'm sure that there were some people that were thinking, oh my God, the client. But the good thing is you already had a couple of solutions, and together you got to a great solution without interrupting the whole shoot. So, I mean, that's definitely a big upside, I would say. You just ended on, you know, the idea of, you know, you wake up on Monday and you can improve your job while sparring with all those different roles and different expertises. What else do you think are the hands-on implications for marketers and agencies on this fictional Monday? And what can they learn from what you are already doing at Hexfix? What do you think?
Yeah, sure. So two very practical thoughts. And it's not just marketing agencies. It's kind of also, imagine you're at a software business and you're a product manager or an engineer or a data analyst, or quite frankly, any job at an agency or any job at a software company or any marketing job. I would do two things that I would consider necessary on Monday. The first thing is that you need to be aware that there's now a new type of skill, and it's called prompt engineering. Now, we've all done prompt engineering in our lives. When you go to Google search for the last decades, if you type in Google something, that's a prompt. Let's call that level one prompt. Give me a gift idea for my anniversary. Let's call that a level one prompt. And for decades, that's kind of been the limit. Like, a lot of people haven't thought past that point. Prompt engineering now goes to level 10. So you need to ask yourself, what is your skill in prompt engineering? And can you get up all the way to level 10 or to level 6 or to 7? And how are you going to get to level 2 and then to level 3 and to level 4? And you need to learn this skill, because these models, these generative AI tools, things like ChatGPT, things like Midjourney, they will only do what you ask them to do. And because they have a bunch of limitations, but also a lot of power and a lot of opportunity, you need to be very good at asking it what you want it to do. That's called prompt engineering. So on Monday, wake up, set aside 30 minutes, and ironically go and Google, what is prompt engineering and how can I get better at it? That's what I would ask any team member to do. No matter if you're an executive, a mid-level manager, a senior individual contributor, or you just started your career, please on Monday go and Google how to improve at prompt engineering. And then the second thing is, as a team, get together and sit down and map out the 10 to 30 tasks that you work on a monthly basis. And then as a team, start pointing out which ones do we think might benefit from generative AI and things like ChatGPT and Midjourney. And then sometimes people have told me, oh, but I don't know. Well, the funny thing is these tools like ChatGPT, they're advanced enough that you can actually ask them. You can give it, these are the 10 tasks that I do on a weekly basis. Which one of these can benefit the most from me combining it, what I do with generative AI? You can literally ask it, and it will tell you with quite a high amount of precision what you should consider doing. Then as a team, for the areas that you've identified, it's time to accept that change is here. This is already happening. Capitalism will not allow for us to be unproductive. These tools are here to stay. And you can decide to be part of that future where we're all more productive, or you can decide to be part of the past. If you decide to be part of the past, you're basically saying what people did two or three decades ago when they didn't want to work with computers and they stuck with their notebooks. Today, if you say, I don't want to use generative AI on my job, I want to stay with things the way that they were, you're basically saying, I think that computers should not be used for my job. Ask yourself, do you really want to reject computers? Would you have rejected computers back then? If you wouldn't reject computers, don't reject generative AI. It's that big of a deal in people's jobs. You have to treat it as an adventure to discover how to make your responsibilities 100% faster. You have to treat it as an adventure to discover how to make your responsibilities 100% easier and to spend time on things that you actually enjoy and that are fulfilling. And it's going to feel like tough change for a while, but you can actively decide if you want to be part of the future or if you want to be part of the people that said to computers, I don't think I should use a computer. I prefer my notebook. It doesn't matter if you just started your career or if you're an executive with 30 years of experience. I'm barely into my second decade of work experience, and stuff has completely changed my job in the last couple of months. So the second thing I'd ask people to do is get together as a team, map out what you work on together as a team, accept the change, ask yourself the computer question, do I prefer to work on a notepad or on a computer? If you prefer to work on a computer, then you should adopt generative AI. And if you don't know how to adopt it, then ask the tool itself how it can be adopted. It will help you adopt it. It's like a teacher. It's not a judge.
Thank you. That's very clear. I already made some notes of what to do next. I also love the way you framed it as an adventure. I think this quest thing is makes it playful and less scary. And I've heard of people doing, you know, lots of prompt nights and combining it with fun and the idea of who creates the best prompts to create the best outputs. So I think there are great ways of doing it like that, while, as you say, it is super important to just start doing it and interacting with it and understanding how it works and what it can do. So we already talked a little bit about what's next. I think you mentioned a couple of thoughts in this last section. But as a final question, we started out looking back 10 years in your work experience. Now, let's end with kind of looking 10 years into the future. What do you think is going to change in the next 10 years? I know it's difficult to project that much time, but or maybe we start with, you know, what is not going to change?
Yeah, I remember when you and I first spoke and you mentioned the idea of a podcast back then. It's like at least 3 months ago, something like that, 2-3 months.
Yeah, something like that.
Back then, I thought I knew what the answer was, but the so much has changed since then already. Let's give you an example. Today, ChatGPT can now do real-time web search. And yes, there were plugins that allowed it to be done before, but those were not native plugins and didn't fully leverage the model's capabilities. So GPT-4 can now be plugged in to real-time web experiences. If marketing and if commerce is at its heart sort of responding to the demands of the market and to the demands of customers and fulfilling them, then now one of the most powerful models in the world is connected to real-time customer needs and can adapt on a daily, hourly, minutely, or even second basis. The second thing that has changed since then is open source models are now very often starting to beat what the big tech companies have. And I thought that this would be the realm of big tech companies only, but the open source world is also really starting to fire up. And so quite frankly, the question of what will be different in 10 years and what will not change. I feel partially out of my depth due to the rate of change. I don't think I'm predicting off of, a stable baseline yet, but I'll do my best. So if I stitch it all together, what will not change if we bring it back to kind of the world that I'm in? Homo sapiens, human beings, we will still need stories. And this is not going to change. Like, generative AI is not going to remove the need for people to have stories to believe in. What will change, though, is how stories are created and told and how often and at the quality level. I think as a race, Homo sapien, for the first time in its existence, is going to be confronted with a tsunami of stories that it cannot tell the difference from reality and falsehoods. And we know this has been coming a little bit with things like deepfake video, but the advent of generative AI, and it's only just started, and this accessibility is going to make the nature of stories in Homo sapien society change a lot. And I don't know how we're going to deal with that, to be honest. Like, I already am more skeptical about what I read and what I hear and what I conclude, because I honestly, I just often don't know if the story is just a hallucination from a model or a reality. And critical thinking is tiring. Like, if we're going to have to spend every single day and every moment of our lives doing critical thinking just to understand what the truth is, that's going to be exhausting. So storytelling is going to change, and we are going to be confronted with a tsunami of stories, and I don't know how to deal with it yet. Secondly, I think in 10 years from now, about 2/3 of the jobs of knowledge workers will have changed by about 80% in what we do day to day. I can already see today in several professions, it's already changed by up to 80% in the last 6 months. It's going fast, and it's only going to accelerate. We're just at the start of what these tools can do. Very practical example. When you prompt ChatGPT, let's call that a single prompt. What you can do now, though, is you can do chain prompting. So first you can tell it how to talk, then you can tell it how to behave, then you can tell it how to think, then you can tell it how to reply, then you can tell it what context to consider, and then you can tell it what context to not consider, and then you can ask the question. So that's 6 prompts in a row. You can chain prompts. And so this model can be put to work 6 times in parallel on the same question. This is mind-blowing. Like, for our tasks that are so simple as knowledge workers day to day, we'll be able to parallelize the majority of our tasks, and we'll be left very often with making the decision or making the high-risk decisions and delegating the medium and low-risk decisions to a system because we've trained it on our own preferences. This is going to happen as well in the next 10 years, and I think maybe even sooner than that, because a constellation of models and chain prompting are in, yeah, another complicated word, but in a vector space, if you think about decision-making and you think about knowledge work, then the rate at which you can accumulate knowledge and the rate at which you can make decisions, that has been changed by several orders of magnitude in months' time. And as a result, the idea of knowledge work has been flipped on its head. It's no longer knowledge work. I don't know. Like, I haven't, you asked me the question, what do I think is going to change? I think the definition of knowledge work is basically already changed, and we need to come up with a new definition because it's not what it used to be. And we're only at the start of this vector space development. This is crazy, like, if you have to think it through. Thirdly, I think that gaps are going to get a little bit bigger between people that adopt these technologies and people that don't. But we've also seen that with the internet. We've seen that with devices like computers. We've seen that with the steam engine. I think as a race, we still very often want to do the best for each other. Like, that's how we got to where we are. Like, we got here because we want to succeed together. And as tribes, we like to face challenges together and that we want to overcome them together. Just like those big changes, this is not going to be a single player journey. It's like, we're all a tribe, like big tribe, small tribe. We need to get through this together. So I think thirdly, what will not change is that this is not going to be a single player journey. It's going to be a multiplayer journey, and we're all in it together. And I'm hopeful about that. Like, we've overcome worse, and this is actually going to make a lot of people's lives better. It's going to be a bumpy ride for a couple of years, but coming out of the other end of it, it's going to make a lot of our lives more fulfilling, I think. So that's my best guess about what will change and what will not change.
I love that, making all our lives more fulfilling. And that I had a similar conversation about that quite recently. And the outcome was also what won't disappear is the need for a human connection. I think that, you know, having more time to actually do that and be together and spend quality time with others, I think if that's an outcome, then that's a beautiful one.
Let me add one more provocative thought. there's some political ideologies that suggest that people should reduce working hours. I'm personally the kind of person, I like to work a lot. It's like work feels like my hobby. I could never imagine working 2 hours a day. Like, just, I think I would get kicked out of the house because I would just be annoying, to be honest.
I can relate to that.
I do think, though, that generative AI is the kind of solution where for capitalism to thrive, productivity must go up, investment must go up, returns must go up. Like, that's the nature of capitalism. Capitalism is a very powerful force. I think most people underestimate the power of that system we all operate in. Generative AI is one of the forces for good in that setup, where you can free up a lot of people that just don't want to participate in types of productivity, and that instead they could maybe be the owners of the rights to productivity. Because you can have a model doing your job for you, you own the rights to that model, and as a result, you earn the economic benefits that that model produces on your behalf. That's not so weird to imagine with a constellation of models and chain prompting. I could probably configure some of these models today already to take over someone's job and do it for them almost on an entirely automated basis. As long as there would be a social contract that it's okay that that person gets paid their salary as well. I think there's something there to make capitalism sustainable with generative AI. It's just one of the many ways it could possibly go. Maybe I'm a bit too optimistic, but I think that that's feasible.
Very interesting thought. And I think a great end to the super interesting conversation, Alex. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts and your passion and excitement for the topic. It's been incredibly inspiring. Thank you.
Yeah, and again, thanks for having me. I was, as I told you, excited to be here. It's an honor. Hope I can help people and help them thrive in this space as well.
Thank you.